So what I want to do to begin with is maybe just explain to you why I think dark matter is an extremely important problem, or at least how I justify to myself that this is a very interesting thing to spend time thinking about. So of course, I think it doesn't need to be stated that we have more pressing problems facing us as a species than dark matter. That's fair enough. But I do think that dark matter is maybe the most interesting problem we have at the moment that we're trying to resolve. The reason for this is that we know with great accuracy that the amount of dark matter in the universe vastly exceeds the amount of regular matter. In particular, and hopefully in this lecture, I'll give you an overview of where this comes from. We know that the energy density in cold dark matter divided by the total matter energy density, and what I mean by this is cold dark matter plus baryons. So in this literature, usually when we talk about everything that isn't cold dark matter, we call it baryons, and that's what makes up everything that we see in this room, you and myself, for example. And maybe I think the reason this is usually done is that most of the mass that comes in these objects is from the protons, and those are, of course, baryons. So if baryonic matter and cold dark matter, you can ask what fraction of this total thing does the cold dark matter make up? And famously, it's 84%. So I think this is a really startling observation that the majority of the matter that we have in the universe is not what we're made of. And so in terms of, you know, as a physicist, we really try and understand what the universe is made of at a very fundamental level. The fact that we don't know what 84% of the matter budget is almost an embarrassing gap in our knowledge about the universe. And the fact that, and really trying to understand that, I think, is something that is very interesting, at least something I'm very justified, or feel very justified in looking into. So two other reasons I think that dark matter is an exceptionally interesting thing to look into is that, well, firstly, as I'll run through in these lectures, we have some very good ideas as to what dark matter could be. I mean, there are ideas like WIMPs and axions that I think are exceptionally plausible candidates for the dark matter of our universe. And why that's very exciting is because if this is what dark matter is, I think we're well placed to make a discovery of what this missing 84% of the matter in the universe is in the next few decades, or maybe even sooner than that. But of course, the truth is we can't be 100% certain. And the other reason I think dark matter is exceptionally exciting is because maybe we've just missed the best idea so far. Maybe there's some other idea about what this matter is that we just haven't appreciated, and maybe someone in this room or someone in our community will come up with this. And once we've done that, we'll really uncover what this mystery is, and that will lead us to the answer. So the fact that both of those things is possible also speaks to the breadth of what we're trying to understand with dark matter at the moment. But for me, I think are two reasons why it's exceptionally exciting. So in the lectures today, what I want to try and give you, or in the next few days, what I want to give you an overview of is firstly focusing on what we actually know for certain about dark matter. And also, I mean, this really goes towards this question of the fact that maybe we haven't had the best ideas yet. And in the second part of the lectures, I'll tell you about what we hope for dark matter, what we think it is at the moment, sort of based on our UV prejudices. And so this in particular, I'll be talking about ideas like WIMPs and axions. But beyond this, I mean, the most important part of what I'll be talking about is what we know. Because as I said, ultimately, maybe these ideas are wrong, but what we know isn't going to go away. So I'll try and focus on that in particular. So we've got four lectures, and roughly how I'd like to outline it is as follows. So the first one is I want to focus on the evidence for dark matter. And this is, of course, coming from experiment. So I'll run through what are the observational evidence we have for this, why are we so convinced that it's there, and more importantly, if we want to come up for some explanation for what the dark matter is, it's these various observational pieces of evidence that all of this will have to be consistent with. Secondly, and hopefully through the first lecture you'll have some idea of why this is justified, I'll tell you about if we take seriously the idea that what dark matter is just some additional particle, well then we also know a lot about it, although maybe not as much as we wished. And so I'll run you through what is the landscape for particle dark matter, the various possibilities of this. So beyond this, I'll move into the more speculative view of this, and this is moving on to what we think dark matter could be. In lecture three, I'll tell you about the famous examples of WIMPs, or weakly interactive massive particles. And then in lecture four, I'll come to what is currently the hottest topic in town in dark matter, and that is axions. But again, the focus is going to be this is what we know, and then this is what we hope might be the case for dark matter. So of course, I can't get the timing exactly right. These might run a little bit over, but that's okay, because I think it's more important that if you take anything away from these lectures, it's the stuff that we know rather than the stuff that we hope. Okay, so with that said, the other thing before I move into the detail of what I want to cover in the first lecture, is just to emphasize, I'm sure, something that everyone else has, and exactly as has already been taken advantage of. Please ask questions whenever you'd like or interrupt me at any point. And the other thing is, I have seen my handwriting. I'm aware it's not always very clear. So if please don't feel embarrassed to interrupt and ask me what I might have written somewhere. I'm always happy to clarify. Please.
Why you have excluded the modified gravity?
I haven't excluded the modified gravity. We'll discuss it here. And then I'll explain how I'll exclude discussing it later on. Yeah. So in lecture one, we're going to cover these ideas. And in fact, partly what I want to cover in lecture one is to ultimately build up to see why do we think particles are such a well-motivated explanation of dark matter. But a priori, I don't think that's at all obvious. You have to really look at the evidence. So we will discuss that in detail. Very good question.
So what does that say before GM on number three?
Particle, PCLE, which is obviously how you spell particle. Yeah. Good question. Thank you. Good. Any other questions about the broad outline before I dive into the evidence we have for dark matter? Good. Okay. Oh, those are beautiful. Very nice. So this is the focus of lecture one. Just what is the actual evidence we have for dark matter? And of course, as a particle physicist, where I'm ultimately hoping to go with this is to try and understand why we might think this is some new particle. So in particular, what I want to focus on today is what is the evidence we have that dark matter exists? And also get some feeling for what are some of the properties it has. We'll really dive into this a bit more in lecture two. But I want to give you some sense, at least, for what are the various properties we have for this substance based upon the various pieces of observational evidence. In particular, I want to run through three pieces of observational evidence, many of which you've probably heard of. Firstly, I'll spend quite a bit of time talking about the famous rotation curves. I think that historically these played a very important role in the community coming to believe that there was something like dark matter there. And I think these are very visceral. Probably many of you have heard of the rotation curves, but if you haven't, that's okay. I'll be going through this. However, hopefully I'll also give you an impression that these are actually quite messy observations here. It took a while for the community to believe that there was something really going wrong here. And actually, even then, the data that we get from this isn't that precise. Nonetheless, they played a very important role historically, and people still discuss them all the time, so it's worth mentioning them. And also, with allusion to the question that was asked, it's really in terms of rotation curves that ideas like modified gravity work best. But as soon as we step away from that, you run into problems. In the second lecture, I'll talk about a very famous object that plays an important role in dark matter, and that's the Bullitt cluster. And the story is a bit more nuanced than I'm making here, but the Bullitt cluster definitely poses a massive problem for ideas like modified gravity. And then the third thing I'll come to, but very briefly, is to talk about the evidence we have for dark matter from the cosmic microwave background. So the reason I'm spending not so much time on this is because these really aren't lectures on cosmology. And to do full justice to the evidence we have for dark matter from the CMB, I need to go through a lot of the aspects of cosmology. Nonetheless, this is actually inversely related to how much evidence we have from these things. I think that the CMB is really where we get the most precise evidence for dark matter, and in particular, this number of 0.84 is coming from the CMB. So although maybe it's a bit harder to intuitively understand, I'll give you some sense for where these pieces of evidence are coming from, it's the CMB where we get the most accurate evidence we have for dark matter. But also remember that really the detailed measurements of the CMB were only made in the 90s. Whereas many of these other things, I mean, for example, Zwicky was thinking about this back in the 1930s. So it was only quite late that we had these pieces of evidence. Please.
And if we try to compute in some way that number from rotation curves, for example, from estimations, how much are they held, do we obtain the same number?
Roughly, but with nowhere near as much accuracy. There's spread between the different objects we look at. I'll say some words about this. But we certainly cannot nail it down with anywhere near the precision we can from the CMB. And in fact, there's other ways of getting this number that actually are independent of the CMB, but that are similarly accurate. But again, they also completely rely on cosmology. So unfortunately, I'm happy to talk about them, but I won't go through all the detailed calculations of that in these lectures. Okay, so I want to eventually work towards each of these topics. But firstly, I mean, this is not a class in history, but I do think this, I found this quite interesting. So I just want to say a few words on the prehistory before we get into rotation curves of dark matter. And so many people, when they're talking about dark matter, actually first attribute these sorts of ideas back to Zwicky and his pioneering work in the 1930s. But actually, I think the story goes even further back than that. One of the first, I mean, really insightful observations that was made was by Lord Kelvin at the turn of the last century, where he realized that if you're studying a system like a population of stars, which is something that we're doing when we're looking at galaxies, you can actually think about each individual star as if they were like a particle in a gas. And through this insight, he realized that you can apply the laws or the understandings we've got from kinetic theory to observations like the distribution of stars in a galaxy. Now, I think maybe from a modern perspective, that's not so surprising, but I think at the time that was exceptionally deep. And a number of people then started applying these ideas from kinetic theory in order to try and determine some basic properties about the motion and the properties of the mass distribution in our own Milky Way, for example. And actually, there were discussions about things like dark matter at around that time. So it wasn't Zwicky who first introduced this. Nonetheless, Zwicky plays an important role here. And this was work that he was doing in the 1930s. And what he did is he used this insight that you can apply kinetic theory to these large astrophysical objects to go even one step further. So what Lord Kelvin said was that you can apply the virial theorem to stars in a galaxy. But what Zwicky said is, let's look even bigger. Let's imagine we study a galaxy cluster, which, for those of you who haven't heard of, this is a bound object where you have, for instance, order 1,000 galaxies that are all gravitationally bound together. It's like a massively upscaled version of the solar system where the planets are replaced by individual galaxies. And what Zwicky did was he treated each galaxy as if it was a particle in a gas. So a bit of a step further, but nonetheless, he wanted to see if this, what you could get from this line of thinking. So in particular, he studied one particular galaxy cluster called the Coma Cluster. And so just to remind you what you can get from the virial theorem, for a central force like gravity, you know that 2 times the average total kinetic energy plus the average potential energy has to be 0, up to the assumptions under which the virial theorem hold, which is, you know, roughly that this system isn't evolving too dramatically. I think from technically you need the average of the derivative of the moment of inertia tensor to be 0, which holds in many stable systems. So if we work out what this is, so this is the average of all the particle masses and velocities. If we imagine that each of the, I mean, if we just want to get a rough estimate here, you can do a more detailed analysis. If we imagine that each of the galaxies in this galaxy cluster have about the same mass, well, then we can take the I off the mass here. And then this isn't quite the average velocity if we move this through, because we've got this sum here. But if we pull out a factor of the total number of galaxies that we're looking at, we end up with this here. So then to study the average our potential energy, this is, you need to be slightly more careful than I'm going to be here, but I'm only going to lie to you by order 1 values. So, which at the level at which Zwicky was working is completely justified. And I need then the average of the separation between the objects here, because this is the gravitational potential energy. Well, again, I need a factor of n. I've mucked that up. To get the average just as we had there, I need a factor of n. So what is this? Well, you need to work this through, and there's a factor of 3/5 that comes out when you think about this carefully. But just ignoring that, I'm just going to say that this is the radius of this galaxy cluster, and again, I'm going to be roughly right up to some order 1 number. So then if I equate these two results, what I'll find is that the average velocity squared up to these factors I've dropped is gm over the radius of the system. So why is this interesting? Well, because what one can do is, if you roughly know the size of the object, and if you know Newton's gravitational constant, you go out and measure the velocity dispersion, or the velocity of the galaxies in this system, and from that, you can infer what is the total mass that you have for this object. However, you can also get the total mass from other ways. You can study these galaxies, look at how much light is coming from them, assume that most of the light in galaxies is coming from stars, and just add that up and try and see if these numbers are close to each other. And what Zwicky did was he applied this and he found that the mass in the system was much, much larger than the mass that you had associated with stars. So this led Zwicky to believe that there was a huge amount of additional matter in these objects that we couldn't see, and he, following others before him, called this dark matter. However, at the time, Zwicky was not thinking about axions or WIMPs. This was something that came much later. Sorry, one second, I'll just finish this thought. Actually, if I take a quote from one of his original papers on this, what he was referring to as dark matter was cool and cold stars, macroscopic and microscopic solid bodies, and gases. So essentially other astrophysical matter that just wasn't stars and very luminous. That's what people were thinking about for what the dark matter would be at the time. They weren't even yet thinking about modified gravity. However, as I'll say some words out throughout this, these other ideas that this is what the dark matter could be were slowly excluded. But that's what Zwicky had in mind when he was talking about dark matter at the time. Please, there was a question. Yeah.
So this is with the assumption, if I'm not wrong, that there's no gravitational force from outside of that closed system.
There's definitely, I can treat the system within itself. If the whole thing is being pulled by some other nearby system, which it will be, the whole universe is I think that these clusters can exist in these even larger structures called like superclusters. These analyses will still hold, right? So I don't think that that's an additional assumption. Is my understanding of this, please. Yeah.
So if I may, I think that, you know, if you have like a symmetrically spherical system, then you can show it like Gauss's theorem that the external forces, you know, cancel out, so it's only what's inside that matters. So that's my understanding of it. I don't know if that's right.
I think that's fair, but again, even if there are corrections, this is all order one correct, and like what Zwicky ended up finding was that it was orders of magnitude separation in these two measurements here. So this is all I want to get at from this. We'll do more careful calculations later on in the lectures, I promise. Yeah, please.
Sorry, you might have mentioned what exactly goes into M star.
No, I didn't go through this in any great detail. Roughly what Zwicky got from this is he looked at how luminous various galaxies were, and then saying this is mostly made up of stars, you could then infer how much stellar matter was in these systems. And from that he could make an estimate for how much matter that is made up of like our own sun is in this, and it was much less than what you could see. So then he concluded, well, maybe there's a ton of additional gas. And in fact, as I'll say a bit later on, this analysis is extremely rough. For example, we know in galaxy clusters, most of the mass isn't in stars, it's actually in gas. So, the most of the baryonic matter. But even once you account for that, you still have a massive shortcoming here. Please, yeah.
That estimation of this velocity, this speed, takes into account like internal motion of particles inside stars, for example, spinning of stars.
So for
the motion.
No, for here you're looking at the motion, like the gas you're studying is each particle is a galaxy. So you're looking at the bulk speed of the galaxy as a whole, was the analysis that was being done here.
Yes, yeah. There's also kinetic energy coming from the internal part of those. Can that affect the computation, the result?
Again, I'm not sure 100% off the top. I mean, you can add additional contributions to the virial theorem, but I don't think this is going to change the overall conclusion that was done here. But no, this is a good question. Nonetheless, I mean, maybe what I think the room is somewhat getting at is that maybe this in and of itself isn't completely convincing. And I think that the field felt exactly the same way. I mean, actually, the main objection that people were raising at the time was that they didn't think the virial theorem held for this system. As I said, this needs to be something that is roughly the system. I mean, if you remember, for the virial theorem to hold, the derivative of the moment of inertia has to be on average vanishing. And if you have some system where it's not even, for example, bound, like maybe one of the galaxies in the coma cluster wasn't even part of it. It could have just been some other galaxy that was flying by. And if that's the case, it would have a much higher velocity, and that could potentially throw this off and give you a wrong mass here. I mean, people argued back and forth about this, but at the time, although historically we often point to Zwicky, the field really didn't coalesce around this as saying this is a massive problem that we have to take seriously. Because there's, there's a lot going in here in order to make this fully precise, which I think that the questions are exactly getting at. But nonetheless, this was a very important in the, I mean, we look back on it now and we realize that Vicky was roughly correct, but at the time people were not at all convinced about what was going on.
The first observation of these rotation curves was for a galaxy or for...
This is not a rotation curve. The first observation for rotation curves came, relatively early on, but they were very imprecise, is what I'll say something about now. And only the first precise measures of rotation curves, which is the motion of stars within a galaxy, is what we a single galaxy, not a galaxy cluster, is what we conventionally call rotation curves. That didn't occur until the 1970s, which is what I want to talk about now. For example, why didn't Zwicky start studying galaxies? Actually, there was some concern at the time that you shouldn't be able to study the individual stars and galaxies as very easily, because people thought the galaxies might be viscous systems due to star-star interactions. Actually, as you probably many of you have heard of, Chandrasekhar eventually realized that the probability of strong star-star interactions in a galaxy is essentially zero. So you can really ignore that when you're treating this, but Zwicky at the time didn't realize that. And this is one of the reasons he didn't bother studying galaxies. He thought the galaxy clusters would be a more interesting system to study. So this was the first, real piece of evidence we had that there was some additional matter, but it was not one that the community really coalesced around. Instead, what started to get people more interested, but again, you will see that even this is slightly messy, are these rotation curves. And traditionally, for good reason, I think, there's a pioneering paper by Rubin and Ford in 1970, that's an O, that got people really seriously thinking about rotation curves. But what they did for the first time, as I'll show you here, is they were the first ones to do really precise measurements of this. People had measured the speed of stars and other objects in galaxies before, but usually they'd have enormous error bars where you really couldn't infer too much from it. What Rubin and Ford did was that they made much better optical telescopes, and from this they were able to do much more precise measurements of what was happening here. So let's start out with some warm-up example before we look at rotation curves. And this is the orbit of the planets. So I appreciate you probably didn't come to this summer school to learn about the orbit of the planets in the solar system. Nonetheless, this will be a reasonably good model for thinking about a lot of aspects of how rotation curves operate. One of the reasons for this is that if we look at all the matter in a galaxy, of course, there's some very complicated distribution. But if I go very far from that, essentially just by the multipole expansion, the total mass of that system has to eventually describe what's going on. So at large radii from galaxies, the orbits of systems have to be exactly the same as essentially the orbit of the planets around the sun. So it's not a completely crazy thing to start with, even though I appreciate that I'm sure many of you have worked through this example before. Good, so let's pick a specific planet, say the Earth. And we want to understand roughly, and I'm going to be... There's many subtleties in all of these things. Let me just put this aside. And of course, this is completely to scale. Here's the sun. And as we know, the distance between the sun and the Earth is on average 1 AU, which makes the units here very easy to keep track of. So if we match the centripetal acceleration to the gravitational force, and what we want to determine is what is the rotational speed of the Earth. And so we cancel the m out and one factor of r. And so v is g naught over r, all square rooted. So if we want to know what this velocity is, well, we know what the distance is. We know what the mass of the sun is. We just need to know what g is, for example. And just to give you a number that is maybe somewhat useful. So to determine this, we can use the following. So I just include this because I was shocked. I only learnt this recently. Does anyone have any idea why the value of g I'm giving here is so accurate? Maybe if you've looked up Newton's constant before, it has far less decimal places than what I'm putting here. There's one special way that I've written it that has allowed me to know it much more accurately than we know G normally. Because the mass scale that I've included here is the solar mass. And so what we know extremely well is the force of the sun on objects around. So the fact that I've written this in terms of a solar mass, we actually know G times the solar mass much better than we know G or we know a solar mass, which I found somewhat amusing. So you can write this out with this level of precision. But I will not use that any further in these lectures, but it's somewhat useful to know. Okay, and then, I mean, this is one way of writing it. I'll say some words about the units in a second. But the sun is not a the Earth is not a kiloparsec from the sun, so that's maybe not the easiest way of writing it. Instead, what you can do is you can show that this is roughly 30 kilometers a second squared, again, in terms of the solar mass, for an AU distance. And so the way that I've written this here, if I substitute this in, the distance of the Earth is 1 AU, and the solar mass will exactly cancel this. And so that tells us that if this Earth quantity, sometimes we put a little plus there, is roughly 30 kilometers a second. So when you're talking about dark matter, it's somewhat inevitable that you're usually describing things on astrophysical, I mean, galactic or even cosmological scales. And when you're doing this, you usually have to spend a lot of time converting between kiloparsecs to meters or centimeters or AU, for example. So maybe I just, because I end up doing this a reasonable amount day to day, I thought I would just share a little aside on how you can easily determine these units. But before I do so, please let me know if there's any questions about the basic setup for the orbit of the Earth around the sun. Good. Oh, yeah, please. Yeah.
Would that change too much if we consider elliptical orbits?
Of course you need, I mean, even Kepler, you do need to consider elliptical orbits. The basic, all I'm trying to get an estimate for here is roughly what is the sizes of these systems, these velocities, because the thing about dark matter is it's like an order of magnitude larger. So keeping track of that is all I'm interested in here. But of course, to do this justice, one can do, and I trust that you all can, so I won't go through this here. But at the level of orders of magnitude, it certainly doesn't change. But in the details, these are important points. You appreciate that. Yeah. So let me just tell you quickly how you can do some of these unit conversions. I'm going to save my favorite unit conversion related to solar masses for this afternoon, so stay tuned. But let me just give you some of these. I mean, the reason the solar mass one is exciting is there's some actual physics in it. These are really just converting between different human-made definitions of units. So as you're probably aware, the distance of the Earth from the sun is about 8 light minutes. And we know this because light takes roughly 8 minutes, as you might have heard, to get from the sun to us. So based on this, we can convert it's going to be 8 times 60 seconds times the speed of light, 10 to the 10 centimeters a second. For whatever reason, when people are dealing with dark matter and astrophysics, commonly we don't work with meters. We tend to work with centimeters. This is just how it is. And so this is a calculation you can carry forward. 8 times 60 is roughly 500, times 3 is 1500. And so this is like 1.5 times 10 to the 13 centimeters. OK, fantastic. That's sometimes useful. And then the other one to keep in mind is 1 parsec. And again, you might know, or it's reasonably easy to remember if not, that a parsec is about 3 light years. And so this means it's 3 times, you know, a year is like pi times 10 to the 7 seconds. I mean, you know this, or if you don't, it's extremely accurate, like up to several decimal places. So if you... Okay, no, I mean, it's when you're doing like order of magnitude calculations, this is very easy, this is very useful to know. And then again, we have 3 times 10 to the 10 centimeters per second. So now 3 by pi is 10, so that's 10 to the 8. Not everything I do will be this rough, but you get the idea. Sorry, it says 10 to the 8, so it's 10 to the 18.
I can already hear the people from the math department screaming.
Well, the fact I'm even using full numbers might be making them uncomfortable. So this is how, I mean, actually kiloparsec to centimeters is something that I do regularly in my day-to-day life. So this is somewhat, I find this somewhat useful. But also, if you ever need to convert between AU and parsec, you can use these to translate between them. So, I mean, this is just that, although these are some silly units that we have to keep track of, it's not that hard to do so. Although, of course, ultimately you can put these things into Mathematica and you don't need to put in pi times 10 to the 7, but I often find it useful in doing estimates. So let's come back to this question of studying the orbits of the planets. So to begin with, we just looked at the motion of Earth, but one of the other things we have about the planets or the objects that orbit the sun is that there's more of them. So let me discuss one that is, I mean, maybe I shouldn't have used planets. But let's consider Pluto. So a fact that you can look up is that the average distance of Pluto from the sun is about 40 AU. So it's quite a bit further out. And this means that from this equation here, I mean, this is obvious, and maybe many of you have already internalized it, but it's good to keep in mind that the further out the planets are, the slower they're moving, because there's a weaker gravitational force. And so the orbital speed of Pluto is going to be the speed of the Earth divided by the square root of 40, and that is 2 times the square root of 10, which is 2 times 3 or 6. And so this is going to be 5 kilometers a second. So it's moving quite a bit slower than the Earth, and it's a lot further out, so it has a much longer period in terms of the time it takes to get around the sun. So one like more general property we can take from this is that there's the the planets all obey something called a Keplerian orbit, which is where the orbital velocity is proportional to 1 over the square root of the distance that they have from the sun. And again, I mean, this is some property of the orbits of planets in our own solar system. But why this is interesting when we're coming to rotation curves is, again, if we get well beyond where we can see any mass from the gravity just by the multipole expansion, we know the total mass will dominate, and we should recover this 1 over the square root of r eventually. So it just gives you some estimate if you want to roughly get the sizes of these, the orbital speeds, what we should have here. And I've got a couple of simple exercises just to make sure that you understand what's going on. But to understand why this is called a Keplerian orbit, you can show this from Kepler's third law. Good, so that's all I wanted to say about the orbits of the planets in the solar system, and as was alluded to in the history of physics, of course, there's been a lot more that can be said on this topic, but that's just to give you some rough sense for what's going on here. And now I want to take this intuition and boost this up to the actual question we care about, which is the motion of objects within galaxies, okay? So the first question, the first challenge I'm going to have here is I have to draw a galaxy, but let me try that out. Does anyone see? There's an horizon. So the galaxy in particular I'm going to try and draw, although my drawings of all galaxies are very similar, is the Andromeda galaxy. And the reason why Andromeda is it was the one that was studied by Rubin and Ford, so of course it's a relevant one to keep in mind. But I think in the history of science, why Andromeda is such an interesting galaxy, I mean, it's our nearest neighbor in the universe. It's only about, it's less than a megaparsec away. And it's also a spiral galaxy, and it's very like our own. So in some senses, if you look out at it, by studying this, we can actually learn a lot about how we expect the Milky Way to behave. And historically, that is what's been done. And it's also very important because actually Andromeda was first realized by Hubble in 1925 to be a separate galaxy from our own. Before 1925, it wasn't even clear that other galaxies existed. So Andromeda was the first one that we really showed for certain was further out. And I find it shocking that it wasn't even older than that we knew that other galaxies existed, but we just didn't have good enough telescopes at the time to determine that. So, I mean, Andromeda is a very important galaxy, not just because of what I'm going to be talking about today. So I'm very interested if other people have better ways of drawing spiral galaxies, but essentially I just draw a hairy spider There we go. And so what we want to understand here is if I just take some star, for example, or some clump of gas, some distance out in this object, how fast is it moving here? So let me just give you some properties of Andromeda, because we want to get a rough feeling for this. Its distance is roughly 750 kiloparsecs, which if you're so inclined, you can now convert to centimeters. Its overall radius is 25 kiloparsecs. And by this, I mean the radius where we can essentially see matter here. Of course, I mean, there's not some hard boundary to the edge of this, but what you see actually is you see roughly it's exponentially declining, and at roughly 25 kiloparsecs, we can't see, at least in the optical, any more significant mass associated with this, this galaxy. Just as an aside, from this, using basic tree, you can work out what is the size of Andromeda on the sky. And it turns out it's about 4 degrees if you measure the diameter. This is actually very large. I mean, 4 isn't a good fraction of 360, but it's still a large number. Just to give you some reference point, the size of the sun on the sky is only 0.5 degrees. And this is obviously a very significant object in the sky. The problem is Andromeda is very dim, so it's very hard to see this. But if you do long exposure photography, Andromeda is an enormous object on the sky. And if you haven't done this before, I really encourage you to look up an image of the Andromeda Galaxy. It's fair to say I'm not doing it justice in what I've written there. So another thing to say is that we know that in Andromeda, similar to our own Milky Way, there's roughly 100 billion stars, so 10 to the 11 stars. And we know in galaxies like our own or Andromeda, the majority of the baryonic matter is in stars. So this is where most of the matter is. And we also know that it's cylindrically symmetric. So this actually, symmetry is always nice, but cylindrical symmetry is not as nice as we would want. I'll come one second. Just to say, as was mentioned earlier on through essentially the gravitational analog of Gauss's law, if you have spherical symmetry, studying these problems is reasonably straightforward. If it's a point mass, it was reasonably straightforward. But if it's some object with cylindrical symmetry, it's a bit harder. I'll tell you roughly how we deal with it, but nonetheless, this is going to be some challenge we have to address. Sorry, there's a question.
Yeah, you said most of the mass is in the stars. For the galaxy cluster, it's mostly in the gas. Is there a difference between clusters?
Absolutely, yeah, good. So the language here is that, it's all a matter of scale to some degree, but essentially, when you're looking at halos, is which we call them, or bound objects of roughly the masses of things like the Milky Way, we can check that most of the matter that they have in them is the baryonic matter is in stars. Now, there's actually a detailed measurement you have to do. You have to go out and measure how much gas is in this system, etc. And for example, in Zwicky's time, they did not know about that, but that is roughly the estimate. But when you look at a galaxy cluster, that's where you have essentially, the dominant thing about galaxies is that optically we can see where most of there's these stars in them. With galaxy clusters, a lot of the space in them hasn't collapsed to form stars. What they are is a bound system where individual galaxies are orbiting each other. For example, the Coma cluster that Zwicky studied was roughly 1,000 galaxies that are all bound together. And even that isn't the largest objects we know in the universe. There are some systems called superclusters, which is like clusters orbiting each other. So, there's some hierarchy here, but at the scales of roughly Milky Way-sized galaxies, we know it's mostly stars. And then you can go to even smaller objects, which I'll say some words about later on, but yeah. And it's not something that is intuitively obvious. You have to go out and do detailed measurements to know why that is the case. Good. Let me finish at the bottom here. Please, yeah.
If it's like a spiral galaxy, what do we mean when we say it's like cylindrically symmetric? Is there some way in which just the arms just don't come into?
The arms, although in my drawing dominate this, in the actual galaxy are not that significant. There's like small there are overdensities where there are the arms, but if you actually look at an object, it's not like there's stars and then nothing. Actually, there's like slight overdensities in what you have here. So they are very accurately cylindrically symmetric. But of course, when you want to go and study these galaxies in full detail, these the arms are something you eventually you'd want to add in. But I can say even in many state-of-the-art models that we use of these, I mean, sometimes you still neglect the arms because they're not that big a perturbation to what's going on here. But yeah, I mean, in the drawing I've given you, the arms look very, very dramatic. So again, I encourage you to have a look at an image here. It turns out they're just very, very accurately cylindrically symmetric, but not perfectly exactly as you're alluding to.
Does it matter if you do it for like bar spiral galaxies like Milky Way?
Oh.
Bar? You don't care.
No. You absolutely do care about this in the details. But again, in terms of the global potential, if we're looking far enough out, the bar is not going to have a huge impact on what we're going on here. But no, you're absolutely right. The bars certainly play a role, especially if you want to understand the orbits of objects very close within the galaxy. For those of you who aren't familiar, there's within this structure, there's actually, we know this in the Milky Way and also in an Andromeda, I believe, there's like there's an overdensity within the stars that we see as we go towards the very inner parts of it, which is where some of the older stars are in this system. But again, this is a complication I'm just putting aside here. So let's start out. What if we go well beyond this galaxy, just to get a feeling for the scale? And let's imagine that I take the radius to be, let's go out at a distance that I've just randomly chosen to be 40 kiloparsecs. Well, because this is reasonably far away from the galaxy, let's just imagine that this is now well approximated as roughly a point mass. And what I can use is my very accurate expression here, but I'll just put that down to 4 for g. It's 4 by 10 to the minus 6. And then I told you the mass is like 10 to the 11 solar masses, so this is 10 to the 11. And this first one I had there was measured in kiloparsecs, so I'll just put 40 on the denominator. And the 4s will cancel. I get 10 to the minus 7, so this will be 10 to the 4 square rooted. And so that will be roughly, it's like 100 kilometers a second. So faster than the orbits of the planets in the solar system, but not dramatically faster. So the object's much more massive, but we're much more further away, and the amounts have roughly compensated each other. So this is roughly the size of the orbital velocities we would expect in objects in these systems. Of course, it's going to get larger as we move in, but it's going to be that order of magnitude. If I put that completely out of reach, oh no, good. Someone's made that mistake before. Good, so what I want to talk about now is how you get the more accurate result. I'll tell you roughly what the answer is. Unfortunately, due to this thing only having cylindrical symmetry, it's quite an involved calculation to figure out what is the rotational speed of objects in this system. But if anyone's interested, most books on galactic dynamics will go through this calculation, but I'm happy to point you to some references if anyone's interested. So observationally, as I said, we know this system is, that is awful, we know this system is roughly cylindrically symmetric. And actually we can map out what is like the surface density of stars in this system. That's something you can imagine doing by just measuring how much light you get from a given distance. The mass of the galaxy or the mass of the stars, however you want to put it. And observationally, the scale radius, which is determining what that drops off, is like 5.3.
Excuse me, what's the first m?
Please, yeah, that's
no,
so.
Sorry.
No, there's only one. Good. So this is a mu. Thank you, that's a mu. Very good question. Mu, this is the surface density of stars we see in the system. Because essentially we're looking side on at the Andromeda galaxy, so we can measure what is the light distribution, saying that's mostly coming from stars, we can determine what is the surface density of these stars. And that's M star here is the total mass of stars in this galaxy. You can confirm that by integrating that expression here.
And
so
what's multiplying M star? Is something squared?
I crossed that out, A. It's the same A that is the scale radius here. Thank you. No, good. So what this is saying is you can just look at images of the Andromeda galaxy, map out how the luminosity changes as a function of distance, and you find it exponentially drops off. However, it is roughly cylindrically symmetric.
So can you repeat what that parameter is?
A?
No, the mu.
Of course, yeah, good. So mu is the, let me write this out, surface density of stars. So this would have units of stars per, I mean, for example, kiloparsec squared. So what I'm doing here, I mean, you could imagine if you really wanted to understand the full system here, what you'd want to look at is the rho, or the density per volume. But I'm essentially what I'm going to do is pretend that this thing's infinitesimally thin. Now, a more detailed calculation can include that, but it turns out that these galaxies are much, much thinner than they are large in radial extent. So that's going to be a reasonable approximation, but again, you can make this better and better and better, please.
So is it like you're taking an infinite plane in the universe and you're looking at how much of that surface is occupied by stars?
Yeah, and eventually it's going to go effectively to zero, but not literally to zero because it's exponentially dropping off. Essentially, is what we see here. If I'm, you know, and I'm just studying the stars in the Andromeda galaxy within that sheet, infinite sheet in the universe. Yeah.
So A is like the thickness. Sorry, I missed.
No, please go.
So what's A?
A is the distance over which you go like 1/E of the central stellar density. So as I've gone to R, the stellar density has gone down by 1/E.
Yes. Oh, okay. So it's just that. It's not like it's just defined at the parameter that does that.
Well, the way that this comes about is observationally. I go and just plot. I find out it's roughly spherically symmetric. Then I can plot, you know, what is the luminosity doing as a function of distance. And I find out it's exponentially dropping off. And then by curve fitting, I determine that the scale over which it's dropping off is 5.3 kiloparsecs. Please.
Is that orientation how Andromeda appears, like, on the sky?
Good question. Not exactly. So you'd think it would be very lucky for it to be exactly in the plane here, but we can measure how far it's tilted and then account for that in this model I'm giving you here. So that's already been accounted for, but you're absolutely right. That's something one has to do. Yeah. Good. So taking this as given, I mean, what you actually need to do here, I mean, with this system having cylindrical symmetry, is you have to solve Poisson's equation to determine the potential. So in detail, where you're just putting in a delta function for the height. And then once you have the potential, you can determine the acceleration, and then you can determine the orbital speeds of these stars. It's quite an involved calculation. I don't think it's potentially illuminating, so I won't go through it, but I'm happy to point anyone to the references if they want. I'll just tell you what the answer is, and then from the answer, you can get a feeling for why it's a bit involved. So M here is the total mass of the galaxy, what I called M star up there. I should be consistent. M cubed. X here is AR over 2. So, I mean, these are the Bessel functions of the first and second kind, and you can see the fact that these have appeared means it's not just going to be some trivial thing that pops out, but nonetheless, this is something that you can determine. And then maybe just to get some familiarity with this expression, I'll give a simple exercise here where I would really recommend doing this in Mathematica, unless you know a lot about Bessel functions. Is show that this becomes exactly what we expected it to. V squared is gm over r at r much, much larger than A inverse. And then, I mean, this is just something to get a feeling for this. At what radius is that a good approximation?
Oh, sorry, what's the symbol? Something squared of R, is it U?
It's V, thank you. No, good. Yes, the same as this one here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In my handwriting, they're almost indistinguishable. So that's a good point. So now this is to say, okay, we had to do a calculation offline that I'm just giving to you here. But nonetheless, people had measured at the time what is the distribution of stars in galaxies. And from this, it's a bit more involved than for the orbits of the planets, but I can then determine what is the rotational speed of objects I expect as I move further and further out. So now we've got the theoretical prediction, and what I want to go back to now is to say, well, what was actually observed when Rubin and Ford did this measurement here. So again, people had made, I mean, this was something that people had known for some time, and people had done some measurements of the orbital speed of objects in galaxies, but people didn't have particularly good measurements of this. And one of the great steps forward that Rubin and Ford had was that they used much more accurate optical telescopes to go and measure, for example, what is the orbital speed of stars in the galaxy, or also what is the orbital speed of clumps of ionized hydrogen, for example, that also emits in the optical, and they could keep track of this. And also in their paper, if you read the original one, they're careful to account for the fact that the galaxy is slightly tilted with respect to us. So let me just show you what they determined. So this is R in kiloparsecs, so radius from the center, and I only need to keep track of this because it's cylindrically symmetric. And then this is V, not U, in kilometers a second. And I know the scale here should be of order hundreds of kilometers a second. And the radius out to which you can measure, well, they shouldn't be able to see much more than 25 kiloparsecs, because that's exactly where I said the galaxy essentially can't see anything in it anymore. So let me go out to 30 here anyway. So first of all, I mean, again, you can check this in Mathematica, but what I will do, peak's about 10. So this is roughly what the prediction is from exponential disk that I put in. And then let me go in an extremely rough way, put in the Rubin and Ford measurements and see what they actually saw. So I have to go out to about 25. Maybe one other data point here. So what they saw was essentially, I would say, at the level of, I mean, of course I've drawn this terribly, but if you go and look at their actual paper, was in pretty good agreement with what you would have predicted from an exponential disk. And in fact, if you go and read their original paper, there was no mention that there's some huge problem in the observations of these galaxies. Nonetheless, I mean, the reason why this was a big step forward was that the results previously were like that, for example, in terms of the measurements that people have made. So this is something you can go in now and actually do really detailed results. So this is... And then to try and separate this. But what else was happening at the time was that people were realizing there were other ways of measuring this. And for example, while we can't see anything in optical beyond about 25 kiloparsecs, there are other things associated with galaxies. For example, there's neutral hydrogen gas that's around and actually extends out further on. And you've probably heard of a very famous way of determining where neutral hydrogen gas is. This is the 21 centimeter line. And so, for example, radio observations that people started to make, partly motivated by the Rubin and Ford results, they were able to measure the orbital speed of clumps of atomic hydrogen even further out. And so there was actually a paper in 1975. And what they saw, I mean, out to about 30 kiloparsecs, I've drawn it a bit further, was that there was starting to be a systematic deviation from what you saw from an exponential disk. But there's really only a hint of it in the last data point or two in the original Rubin and Ford result. And so I think that, I mean, while this was a very important paper for the reason that I mentioned, at the time, in and of itself, people weren't jumping up and down and saying there's some massive issue that we have to resolve here. However, eventually the field started to coalesce, because it wasn't just, I mean, as we now understand, there is a huge number of galaxies in the universe. Andromeda is just one of them. And as we measure the rotation curves in all of these different systems, eventually we started to see this plateauing behavior. And as you go further and further out, I mean, essentially, I mean, even if you didn't trust the measurements just from the luminosity there, if whatever this thing is, if it's cylindrically distributed, you could just fit it to the data points we have here, and there's just no way to make the data that we measure out here consistent with the data that we have in here with that prediction that we had. And in fact, as you've probably heard of, there's this very famous result that the orbital speeds were plateauing to a value of about 200 kilometers a second. But then what's interesting about this is that at some point we can't even see, there's no more even atomic hydrogen to keep track of. So even radio can't go out indefinitely. And what we see is that there's no obvious change in behavior to what's happening to this system as far out as we can essentially image anything. So the question people started to wonder is, if you have this flat rotation curve, I mean, what on earth could generate this? And it's maybe a fun exercise to think about for a while, various ways that you could do this. But I can just tell you one simple answer that will give you the right thing. So how do you get these flat rotation curves? Well, one very simple answer to this is imagine we have a spherically symmetric distribution, because now I can actually do the calculation on the board. And in particular, if I choose this spherically symmetric distribution to be proportional to 1 over r squared, maybe just write that because my handwriting's awful, squared, we'll just check that what we actually get out is indeed a constant. So because of this spherical symmetry, all we need to worry about is what is the enclosed mass at a given radius divided by r. That's m subscript enc for enclosed. Then this is going to be proportional to, I pull the 1 over r out, I'll drop the g. I just want to check how this is scaling with radius. So of course, what I need to do is I need to integrate over the mass distribution here, which is r prime, and keeping track of the Jacobian. Was that from Zoom?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, and people on Zoom are able to ask. They've already told me that they couldn't hear me. So please always feel free to ask questions if you want. So these will cancel. And then what I'm going to get from this integral here, I've used all sorts of different symbols. Let me keep track of just this one r here. I'm going to get r from this, and I'm going to get 1 over r. So this indeed will just be a constant. But this is just a mathematical curiosity at the moment. The fact that if I had such a spherical distribution of matter, then it would give me a constant rotation curve. But the reality is there's nothing we see in these spiral galaxies that has that distribution. And not only that, we know it has to go out further than anything we can see. So this, okay, it seems to make things work, but it seems to be quite a shocking realization in and of itself. And in fact, what we now roughly suspect is that this distribution of matter extends out to roughly 200 kiloparsecs. So an order of magnitude beyond where we can see any conventional matter here. And it makes, if you could actually see the dark matter halo of Andromeda on the sky, it would be enormous. It would be a very, very large portion of what we can see from Earth. So this is the sort of things that people are being pushed towards, but there's a lot of questions that remains. Nonetheless, let me just...
Excuse me?
Yes, I can hear you. Do you have a question?
I have a question regarding the curve you draw.
Regarding what? Sorry, I couldn't hear.
Yes. Why the curve is not extending? The curve stops at after. Have you understood my question?
You're asking why I didn't keep drawing this here?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
No. That's totally fine. One indeed can, and you know what it's going to do at large radii. You know it's going to go as 1 over the square root of r. Because that's what I got you to show here. The reason I didn't draw it any further is we have no measurements out beyond that. Of course, you could say if you could see something, you could predict what it would be. But even where we do have measurements, I can see it dropping off. It doesn't just end here. I've just chosen to stop drawing it here.
Thank you.
No. Thanks for the question.
Good. I have a question.
Please, yeah.
How do you get the measurement of until where the dark matter halo extends?
So this is, largely where we... this even comes back to, where do you even determine the edge of an object? There turns out to be a technical definition where, what we think of as some continuous distribution of dark matter, and locally we have an overdensity. So where do you actually determine the edge of that? There's some technical definition we have. So this is not very satisfying for this. But in terms of where you have an overdensity that is essentially larger than what you would have averaged throughout the galaxy, it's up to roughly 200 kiloparsecs. So observationally, we can't see it. I'll come back to this later. Like, there's further objects we can see from this. They're actually like little galaxies that orbit our own Milky Way. You might have heard of like the Magellanic Clouds, for example, or other ones like this. Some of these orbit quite a bit further away, and from that we can measure some objects at the potential out to further, but not to 200 kiloparsecs. And for that, we really have to go for like simulations of what we think dark matter is doing, and we learn something from that. But look, I say 200, but it's really not a hard drop-off. It's somewhat arbitrary. But the statement is it does extend much further than the regular matter. Very good question. Good, so let me just say what we think what we actually think is going on from a more modern perspective. But how we determine this is we essentially do numerical simulations of how we think dark matter behaves. And because in the simulation we can see dark matter because we put it in, we can determine how it's distributed. And the modern picture is that it's not exactly 1 over r squared. It's something called a Navarro-Frank-White profile. Even this isn't exactly correct, but it seems like a very good approximation to what's going on. Excuse me. And here you find that there's some transition between 1 over r and 1 over r cubed. But at some point it's reasonably well approximated by 1 over r squared, and so you get the flat rotation curve. So this is what we see at the moment. So I just want to, I mean, one of the things hopefully you've got from this is that you do see some evidence that something's going wrong, but again, it's slightly a messier story than maybe you historically thought the rotation curves were. There's no mention in the original Rubin and Ford paper that something is seriously going wrong at the time. So I think maybe just to give you a bit more of a feeling for what's going on here, let me give you one exercise that I found illuminating in terms of understanding this. So I can tell you that the total dark matter mass in an object like Andromeda is roughly 10 to the 12 solar masses. So it's one order of magnitude larger than the regular matter. And also I can tell you that this RS above is about 35 kiloparsecs, though there's a lot of uncertainty on that. So you can use this distribution to compute the velocity distribution you'd get from an NFW. In the same way we did for the isothermal sphere, it's just slightly, for the 1 over r squared, just slightly more complicated. And have a look at what this does out to 200 kiloparsecs. The other thing, though, to do is that we don't think it's just dark matter. It's dark matter plus the stars, plus a bulge, for example, which was mentioned earlier. But let me not ask you to add the bulge in. So if you take that distribution I gave you earlier on, the one with the Bessel functions in it, if you include that, and I gave you the value of A, it's 5.3 kiloparsecs. Figure out what is the rotation curve when you add the two together. From the disk plus the dark matter. And the question is, we don't live at the very edge of a galaxy. Actually, I'll mention this in a bit, but we think, we know, we roughly live about 8 kiloparsecs from the center of our own Milky Way. So which of these two distributions at 8 kiloparsecs, which is where we would live in the Andromeda galaxy if we just translated our position over there. And so, of course, there's more mass in the dark matter, but the baryonic matter is more tightly clustered, so maybe it's not immediately obvious which one's going to dominate there. But I think if you understand this, you'll get some sense for why these measurements are somewhat involved. Please.
Yeah, what's the L? You know, there's M star. What's the L right to the L right to the left of that?
This one?
Yeah.
If. Thank you. Oh, God. Yeah, yeah. Please. No, I'm not embarrassed. I've lived with this handwriting my whole life. Where the NFW profile comes from is people put in objects that, I mean, it doesn't matter that they don't emit light, but they have mass, and then they let these objects evolve under gravity and see what are the eventual halos that we build up. And then they look at them and they find that universally an NFW is an exceptionally good fit in dark matter-only simulations, which is a good starting point because the dark matter is most of the matter. And so this purely comes from simulations. Now, various aspects of this we can try and infer from the measurements, but also a lot of the time the NFW is a reasonably good fit. There are caveats to that statement, but it actually comes from simulations.
No, I was thinking, so this fit is done to reproduce those speeds. But what happens if we do a fit, if we start with something, we let this mass cluster? Can we get to that kind of distribution?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, this is what... So we don't... one of the miracles... I mean, there's some starting point for... So what we do is we fix the distributions to what we see from the CMB, and then we just let this thing cluster for a huge amount of time, and we end up finding things that are roughly NFWs with a mass distribution that reasonably describes what's going on here. Now, again, it's at the level where if you start asking too many detailed questions, it doesn't always work out. But over the years, people have, as they've made them more and more refined, for example, initially people didn't add baryons in because you know you think that they're only a small fraction of the matter. So what actually ends up happening is the baryons do matter through the form of supernovas because they push things out and they especially the inner parts of galaxies can have a big impact on what's going on here. So there was some debate for a long time about how good a model this NFW profile is because there was some deviation from this 1 over R that it predicts, but we think that most of that is coming from baryonic feedback, not something else potentially. But this is a very good question. There's a lot more that could be said about this. So what I've given you from this is really the story that we had from 1970 up until the mid-1990s where we got the CMB observations that I had. And again, I mean, you can see that this is quite messy. I mean, the error bars aren't infinitesimal. And so people really argued whether there's a problem here or not, or maybe that we're just not measuring things correctly. And again, no one in 1970 was saying that this had to be WIMPs or axions. Again, what people were thinking about is maybe it could just be a distribution of planets. They're not very bright, we can't see them, or very dim stars, for instance. Why they would be so massively puffed around galaxies wasn't clear, but maybe that's the case. Another idea that people put forward was gas. This was something that people were really thinking seriously about at the time. It could be some large distribution of gas. However, gas emits at some wavelength. And what people did is eventually through various observations, they could set limits on how much gas was there. So what we're able to do was say that there wasn't enough gas in here to make up the dark matter. So that's what people thought about initially, and I think that's the reasonable approach to take, but it was slowly excluded. I mean, as much as it might seem bizarre that there could be these planets, an enormous number of them distributed around, that was a possibility. And as I'll say later on, or it might have to be this afternoon, we had to go to the CMB to eventually rule out the possibility that it was some distribution of not luminous stars or planets, for instance. But that's...
Can I just ask you?
Of course, yeah.
You touched on it, I think. This is the core cusp.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
What's the status?
The status of that is that baryonic feedback seems to essentially explain this. Right. Now, not everyone...
This is the problem in some sense, right? R goes to zero, that density.
Exactly, yeah. So just to say, like, so what if you plot this density profile here? What you will see is that it's quite sharply rising. It's got this 1 over R in here. And then what you can then go and do is through measurements of... The speed of various stars and galaxies, you can try and map this out and see, is this what happens? Or does it actually core, is what people call it, where it turns over here and it flattens at some point. And famously, this NFW profile also holds for smaller galaxies, not just our own Milky Way, but also the famous dwarf galaxies, which are some of these objects orbiting around. And what people saw was that there did seem to be some flattening out of what was going on here. And so people said, well, the NFW profile can't be right. But this is all that comes out of these dark matter-only simulations. So for a while, and I think it's still a very interesting direction to pursue, people thought, well, maybe you could modify dark matter. People talk about self-interacting dark matter that could flatten this out as well. But actually what I think the field has largely coalesced around is as soon as people put supernova feedback into galaxies, they also saw at these small scales that you get this turnover here. So you don't need to change dark matter, really just accurately putting in baryons. But the reason it took a while is that's very hard. But I think that we can now do this reliably, and I think that the core cusp problem is largely resolved based on that there. Great question. So anything else about rotation curves before I turn to the Bullet cluster? Please.
So the NFW profile is only for spiral galaxies, or is there a similar different profile for elliptical galaxies?
Again, we think the dark matter in both of those is very well described by an NFW. I mean, the other thing to say here, just if we're starting to think about what properties this substance has to have, why do we get disk galaxies in disks in the baryonic sector? And the reason is because baryonic matter can lose energy. And when it loses energy, the distribution starts to collapse, but it can't just collapse to a point because it has to conserve angular momentum. So this is why you end up with a disk. So what we learn about dark matter is that if it can dissipate energy, it cannot do so efficiently enough that it collapses down and forms disk, for example. We don't see any evidence for disk-like structures of dark matter. There has been a claim that maybe a small, so we know that as a whole, but then you can ask questions like, well, maybe 1% of dark matter can dissipate and collapse. And for example, there's ideas called like a dark disk, where you do have a dissipative dark sector, and you end up collapsing and forming some dark disk. And Lisa Randall had a popular science book about maybe this played a role in the extinction of the dinosaurs. So you can have a read about that. I mean, although that's sounds a bit outlandish, it's a very serious a proposal that one can go and test. But we know that 100% of the dark matter can't be doing that, for instance. Yeah, it seems remarkable that the NFW profile seems to be so accurate. It seems to hold for the dark matter distribution in clusters all the way down to much, much smaller structures. There seems to be some universality about this, and it would be deeply satisfying if someone could analytically derive why you end up getting towards the NFW profile. No one has been able to do that, as far as I'm aware. It just comes out of fitting to simulations. Good, so this was the part of the evidence for dark matter that I wanted to spend the most time on, but hopefully you've gotten the impression that, you know, people started taking this, some people took this seriously, but it's a bit messy. And certainly as you're galaxy to galaxy, you're not gonna get something as precise as 0.84 out of this. And so for instance, the other possibility that was being discussed in terms of explaining rotation curves is that at the time people were talking about some distribution of planets that extended out much, much further than all the other matter we could see. How on earth could have that come about? I mean, it seemed very outlandish at the time. And so one, I think, very interesting proposal that was put forward was modified gravity. This was this idea of modified Newtonian dynamics, or MOND, from Moddy Milgram in 1982 or 1983. And essentially what he proposed was that at the larger scales that we're probing here, gravity might just work slightly differently. It was a very interesting idea, but I mean, the initial proposal theoretically was not very satisfying. For example, if you studied it in detail, what you found was that the theory that was written down didn't conserve energy, didn't conserve momentum, didn't conserve angular momentum. I mean, maybe this is just how things were, but that wasn't very satisfying. And as refinements, there have been refinements of that theory that have been put forward that do fix those problems with it. But nonetheless, I mean, as we'll come to these later observations, it becomes very challenging to explain how they can be consistent with what's being seen. The level of rotation curves, MOND seems to work quite well. I mean, we can go into details. I think there are some things MOND struggles with, but even, for example, there are various predictions that MOND made about what we should see as we measure more rotation curves that turned out to be true. I mean, I now think we understand the particle dark matter can also explain these, but MOND was a very reasonable idea that was put forward, and it was put forward before the later measurements I'm going to tell you about were understood. But I think at the moment it just doesn't stand up to the data. Good, so let's move on to the next thing. The thing that, I mean, it's a bit more nuanced than this, but I do think roughly kills the MOND idea, which is the bullet cluster. But before I do so.
I was just wondering about modern MOND theories. Do they solve these kind of issues you were talking about, the first ones?
So yes, they do, because you can write down Lorentz invariant. I believe there's this theory called Tevez that I haven't dug into, like tensor vector scalar theory. But you have to add degrees of freedom to MOND to make this work. And then these additional degrees of freedom in some of the theories that they claim to make work behave a bit like dark matter, and then they can be consistent with the CMB or the bullet cluster. But it's essentially you've added dark matter to MOND, and then that's what makes it work. So I don't find that deeply convincing, and I think that's what, nor does the field as a whole, I think that's why it's not widely discussed. However, I don't think that, I mean, sometimes people are a bit dismissive of MOND. I think at the time it was an exceptionally well-motivated idea to try and test this hypothesis, but essentially we have, and I think the data really doesn't speak in favor of it. Good, so let me say a few words now about the bullet cluster. And if you enjoyed my drawing of galaxies, here comes my drawing of galaxy clusters. So the bullet cluster was something that was discovered in the year 2000, roughly. And it's very far away from us, 1 gigaparsec, which is an order of the size of the observable universe. So what the bullet cluster is it's an observation of colliding galaxy clusters, okay? Now, the timescale over which such a thing exists is much longer than a human lifetime. So actually what's convenient about this is we saw the aftermath of the collision. But just to begin with, I'm going to draw roughly what we thought the system looked like beforehand. We have other systems we can look at to understand this, and then we'll see what they actually saw. So I'll just give up and draw a sphere for a cluster, but then it's full of many hairy spiders. So as I said, there's order 1,000, but let me not make you suffer through that. I'll draw four. They're not even pointing all the same direction. Good. Okay, there's one galaxy cluster. Here's my second one. This one only has two galaxies. That's okay. So what was mentioned earlier on is that actually we now know from observations that most of the mass in this system is, this is how I should have used a different color, but I'm committed now. This is what I would call a gas. In this system. So most of the matter is in the gas, not in the stars. This is not obvious a priori, you just have to go away and do the measurements. That was what was done. Also, I can give you a rough scale for what, so these things are heading towards each other, a rough scale for what's going on. The mass is roughly 10 to the 15 solar masses, so about three orders of magnitude heavier than the Milky Way. And these are enormous objects. The radius of these systems is roughly a megaparsec. So that was the before. I'll bring this back down in a second. Let me just draw the after. And the after is, of course, what we actually see.
Okay. That mass is visible, right? Baryonic mass.
Oh, sorry. This is the total mass, including dark matter. So, I mean, if I want to get the baryonic matter, it's about 10 to the 14. I go roughly one order of magnitude down. No, great question. Thank you. I should even add that. Oh, let's put total. But it's dominated by the dark matter. So what we saw afterwards, so what's going to happen to the galaxies when they pass through each other? Does anyone have a guess? Are they going to collide and get stuck?
Nothing, right?
Yeah, nothing, because they're mostly, yeah, it's the same as the Chandrasekhar argument. They're mostly made of stars, and in these systems, you can check that as you add more and more stars, the collision cross-section goes down, which is counterintuitive, but you can show that.
Is there a physical reason for that?
Yes, there is. As you make the system, as you add more stars, you increase the total mass of the system. By the virial theorem, you increase the average velocity of these stars. Gravity, the gravitational cross-section for a system increases the slower it's moving because the force of gravity has time to act on these things. So if they're moving faster, the cross-section goes down. Adding more stars gives you more targets, but the cross-section is going down faster than you're adding targets, and so that ends up winning. But it's slightly counterintuitive, which is why someone as smart as Chandrasekhar had to figure it out, but that's the reason why it goes that way. It's a very beautiful argument, yeah. So yeah, the galaxies essentially fly through each other. So there, we see them over here, but they're not where most of the matter is. The baryonic matter, they're here. What we can also then see is we can image the gas hits each other, and a lot of this is ionized. So it's actually strongly collisional because it's interacting through the Coulomb interaction. And we can check that most of the gas gets trapped in the middle. And in fact, we can see this in X-ray because they become very hot and are actually emitting in X-ray. Then the question is, where is the matter? And or most of the matter that is sourcing the gravity here. And we can infer that from lensing observations. This thing at a gigaparsec is far away, but there are many objects behind it. And we can actually look at how they're being lensed to determine where is the matter in this system. And the matter has followed the stars. And so this is the matter, and we get from lensing. So what's striking about this system is that the matter has completely separated from where the baryonic matter is here. So a priori, this is a really challenging thing to explain with MOND, because with MOND, you want to modify the interaction between the systems, but the force is still sourced by the where most of the baryonic matter is. How have you got a complete, it'll require some bizarre non-locality to explain how this matter here is sourcing matter distributions over here. So of course you have to work through these more complicated theories like Tevez, for example, to see what's going on. But my understanding is, to the extent they can make this work, they require that one of these other objects that's behaving like dark matter ends up doing the lensing here. So this is a very difficult thing to explain if you just modify gravity, for instance. Please. Yeah.
Does this imply that dark matter also has some sort of galaxy structure that they don't collide with each other?
You're exactly, you've absolutely preempted my next point. Great. Yeah, yeah. So what we learn is that something about dark matter is similar to something about galaxies. And the thing that we claim to learn from this is that dark matter is largely non-collisional. If dark matter was interacting with itself very strongly, it also would have got stuck in the middle like the gas does. And the fact that this has moved through tells me that I don't have any evidence that dark matter is collisional. And this is famously what we use the Bullitt cluster to say is there's a limit on how strongly self-interacting dark matter could be coming from the Bullitt cluster. And what I wanted to do now is just really roughly ballpark what that number was. And I'll tell you what the actual accurate number is in a second. Yeah, please.
I wanted to do a very similar question, but up to what point we can say that dark matter is collisionless?
At the level I'm about to tell you now, yeah.
No, and up to what point, because it could be like in galaxies, let's say, of dark matter or something like that, so it doesn't collide because of that.
I think, yeah, actually the question you're asking is a very insightful one, because you'd have to think, for this to be the case, some property of dark matter would have to vary between these systems, for instance. But there are things that vary between these systems. For example, galaxy clusters are more massive than the Milky Way. And the more massive the object, the faster it's moving, for example. And so if you have some interaction cross-section that changes as a function of velocity, then you can potentially play this game. And actually, this is a huge field of research, self-interacting dark matter. People look, you usually have to invoke some model where you have a velocity dependence to the cross-section in order to explain that. But it's definitely something that one can consider. But if you just take the simple velocity-independent approach, you'll get a straight bound, which is what I'm going to roughly estimate for you right now. Very good question. Please.
Thank you. So I'm not very well experienced, but if there are such observations regarding the gravitational lensing occurring in such systems, is it matching or compatible with the mass distribution?
My understanding is yes, but that's a reasonable question. I can't give you a more detailed answer to at the moment. The reason I say that is I've never heard anyone worried about what they've seen in the Bullitt cluster, but other than skimming the original paper, I haven't looked at that in detail. It's a fair question, but I think the answer is it seems to work pretty well. Yeah.
So you're saying the gas is like, you know, well accounted for, like, you know, well understood there, and it's like, and the dark matter has followed the galaxies, right? So what was that point about that it's like it's non-local then, if the dark matter isn't in the middle?
Good. No, yeah. No, great. Yeah, let me just emphasize this. So, of course, again, in astro, you know, usually we're working at the levels of orders of magnitude. So it's not that everything is completely well characterized, but we know that most of the matter in galaxy clusters is in gas. And then we can see what this is what we see for the Bullitt cluster. I mean, again, there's a much more beautiful version online. And the gas emits in X-rays. We've taken X-ray observations of this system, and we see it's all stuck here in the middle, because it's interacting very strongly. This is ionized gas, and so it's got trapped here. But then what we go and do is we go and see, well, where is most of the mass? We know that mass bends light, and so we can look, where is most of the lensing occurring? And it's occurring at a spatially separated location from the gas. So if you have a theory of modified gravity, this is what has to be sourcing the gravitational impact, and where it's sourcing it, an effect is away from where it is. So that would be in the, I mean, I said some non-locality. No one's written down a theory, as far as I'm aware, that can do anything like this. It just
okay. So yeah. It's like it's that the lensing is on the sides, but not in the middle.
Exactly. Yeah.
In the middle and not on the sides.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. If that makes sense. Yeah. If we saw it right in the middle, well, that would be, or some modified version of that in the middle, that would be what MOM would predict.
Okay.
Essentially. Yeah. So let me just do this estimate. As I said, I wanted to give far too little detail to the CMB, but I can do that in the 5 minutes at the start of next lecture. Let me just do this, and then we can finish up. So as was correctly already observed, what we learn from this is also that dark matter is roughly collisionless. And so one way, let me just do a really crude estimate of this. Of course, you can sit down and do things more accurate. But let's imagine that whatever this is, it's made up of particles, but when I say particles, I don't necessarily mean like a WIMP. It could be, for example, a planet or whatever else that this is, but some object, right? At the level of 10 to the 15 solar masses, a planet is about as far away from that as a WIMP is. So let's just imagine that we have a whole bunch of particles, and let's just take one of these particles. Let's take it from the before, of course. Let's take one of the particles here, and ask what is the probability that it doesn't scatter with all of the particles that we have on the other side. If I have some interaction cross-section, I can take the distribution of these and they'll map out some collisional area that I could hit. And I want to have that to be smaller than the size of the galaxy so that there's gaps where this particle could go through and it wouldn't collide. So this is a very, very crude estimate of what is going to be the bound I could get from this, because we didn't see any obvious evidence of it scattering, but it turns out at least it'll get the orders of magnitude right. So on the first side, what is the area that we would get for a given collisional cross-section? Well, this depends on how many particles there are in one of these galaxies times by what is the collisional cross-section between two dark matter particles. In order for there to be some probability that this particle flies through without colliding, I want that to be less than the cross-sectional area of the galaxy cluster. So our halo here is like a megaparsec that we said. Okay, but we don't know how many dark matter particles are in this object. It depends on what the mass of those particles are. And I may have not used this before, but I'll use this throughout these lectures. Chi is generically the symbol that we give for dark matter. So, whatever that happens to be. So this is the dark matter interaction cross-section. So I know that the number of particles, though, it's the mass of the halo divided by the mass of dark matter.
Interaction, you mean gravity, just gravity or something?
We know that it interacts gravitationally, but it will interact weak. Well, anyway, let me come back to that in a second. What I'm imagining here is that there's some other interaction cross-section here, right? So what you imagine that maybe dark matter is some like QCD type state, or when it passes near each other, it could have some strong interaction cross-section with itself. Or maybe there's some new force in the dark sector that acts at long ranges, in which case you could have a very large cross-section on it. That's the sort of cross-section I'm imagining including here. For the gravitational interaction, there is a collisional cross-section, but by the Chandrasekhar argument, because that cross-section goes inversely with the velocity to some power, I think it's v to the 4, but I'd have to double check, you know that it's not going to be particularly relevant. In principle, you can put that in here, but I already know that it's not going to be there. Right? But yeah, good point. So let me just put this in here. The heavier the dark matter, the fewer particles we have. And so if you rearrange this, what that tells you is that, let me just write it this way in terms of the things we don't know. So I'll keep this here, but I'll move the halo mass to the other side. So I know the cross-section divided by the dark matter mass. I can put some numbers in. I was just happy that the numbers worked out the way they did. So of course, I don't need to tell you how to convert megaparsecs to centimeters. You're experts on this. It's come up again. And then the halo mass. Well, the sun is like 10 to the 30 kilograms. As I said, next lecture, there's a better way of understanding this. 10 to the 30 kilograms or 10 to the 33 grams, and this is 10 to the 15. Well, it's actually 2 by for the sun, 2 by 10 to the 30 kilograms. So this is 2 by 10 to the 48 grams. So you're going to get a power of 10 to the 48 here and a power of 10 to the 48 there. They'll cancel. And then what you have is 10 divided by 2. So this is roughly, if you work this out, I got that right. Sorry, there's another 3 here, 30 divided by 2, which is 15 centimeters squared per gram. So this is measuring the dark matter mass in grams and the cross-section in centimeters squared, which is naturally what has come out of this here. And then to tell you, if you do a detailed analysis, you get something that's closer to sigma over m is like 1 centimeter squared per gram. So of course, this was extremely crude. So if you did a more detailed analysis, you can do better, but at least you can roughly understand maybe where the units are coming from here. That it's of the order of centimeter squared per gram. So that may not be how you think about particle masses or cross sections. So for example, just if you want to get a feeling for this, what is this cross section in bonds if the dark matter mass is 1 GeV, so a proton mass? Is it a strong bound? So that's something just to get a feeling for this. But again, there can be a lot more nuances that go into this that's already been touched on. But this is roughly the scale of the bound we get from the Bullitt cluster. So again, the takeaway from this is it's a struggle for MOND. And also, it's roughly we learn that dark matter is roughly collisionless. So in the start of this afternoon's lecture, I'll tell you about really very briefly where we get all of the significant evidence for dark matter, which is the CMB, and then I'll go on to tell you about why we, if we start thinking about it as a particle, how we can cover that parameter space. But given it's lunchtime, let me leave it there, unless there are any final questions people want to ask me about.